Well, it's certainly no secret that things are not always as they seem. To prove the point, let me have you watch on the screen a news story that made the rounds a couple months ago.
A zoo in Egypt is accused of trying to fool visitors by painting zebra stripes on donkeys. A student visiting the zoo noticed smudges on the animal's face and took this picture. Zoo officials insist the animals are, in fact, zebras, but animal experts say real zebras have black snouts and more consistent parallel stripes. They are also bigger than donkeys. Now, this is not the first time a zoo has seen controversy over a zebra donkey dupe. In 2009, a zoo in Gaza admitted to painting two donkeys with black and white stripes.
All right, we began the fall with an invitation to do something dangerous, to pray a dangerous prayer. It comes from Psalm 139. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. So as we're focusing on spiritual formation, we are asking God to help us to truly know our own hearts and to do a deep dive into our anxious thoughts. And today, we're looking at the thoughts of deception, at beating deception. Now, our own deceptions may not be as blatant and as obvious as a zookeeper making a zebra out of a donkey, but deceit comes out of our hearts in lots of ways that we might not notice ourselves. In fact, we might actually be more like donkeys trying to make ourselves look like zebras. So to get started, as we've done each Sunday, I want to do a little self-assessment. I'm just going to ask you to ask yourself, do any of the following statements characterize you? Can you say yes to any of these things? I can find a way to win over and connect with just about anyone. I keep a close watch on how people are responding to me in the moment. How you look and what you've done tells people what to think and feel about you. You must be successful and achieve in order to inspire admiration and respect from others. It is important to have the right image for every context so that people will think well of you. I know how to airbrush failure so it looks like success. I don't talk much about my feelings or personal life because feelings aren't as important as getting things done, and they just get in the way. If you are saying yes to any of those things, then I want to invite you to explore what's going on underneath the surface of your life and to know your heart and to know that it just might beat with deceit. Let's look at some scripture together. Matthew 23 is where we're going to go first. If you'd like to, open up a Bible and turn there with me. Follow along and I'll read aloud for us here. Matthew 23, beginning in verse 1. Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogue. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplace and to be called rabbi by others." Now, what I want you to hear is right there in verse 5. Everything they do is done for people to see. This is at the core of deceit. Let's define deceit a little bit more. Because see, deceit is not the same thing as lying. I'm going to assume that most of us are on the same page, and we could agree this morning that lying generally is a sin. After all, you think of one of the Ten Commandments, the Big Ten, says, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." So lies are blatant untruths and false statements. Deceit, on the other hand, is far more clever and sneaky. You see, deceit wants you to believe something less than the full truth, even without necessarily telling you something that is fully false. Deceit is not a bald-faced lie, but a more subtle distortion and a manipulation. We engage in deceit when we shade things to the positive. We present things about us only in their best light, perhaps better than they really are. We amplify and we inflate. We exaggerate our accomplishments and embellish our successes and highlight our connections with other accomplished and successful people. And we engage in deceit when we cover over the negative. We airbrush our failures to make them look like success. We either pass the buck or we distance ourselves by bailing out when things go wrong. And we treat weakness with the spin of a job interview. You know what happens in job interviews? You've all probably seen or experienced this, right? The interviewer asks the question, well, tell me about some of your weaknesses. Ready to go. And then what's the normal answer? Oh, yeah. One of my weaknesses is I work too hard. Oh, yeah, works too hard. A hard worker. Yeah, that works for us. We airbrush. See, deceit is my painting on black stripes to make you think a donkey is a zebra. And the most fertile ground for deceit is to grow in the image that we project to other people. Some of us have gotten really good at being able to read a room when we walk in and to see who is there. And we walk into the room and we can ask, well, what persona do I need to craft and to put on to win these people's approval? What do they want me to become before they'll love and admire me? So we become shapeshifters, chameleons, if you will, and we switch personas to match the environment. And make no mistake, this does get rewarded and reinforced by the world around us. Consider the teachers of the law and the Pharisees that Jesus warns the disciples about. They lived with a constant preoccupation with how they looked in the eyes of the other people. They became good at playing a role or acting a part, at marketing themselves through good packaging and selling themselves as good people worth admiring and respecting. And they were rewarded for their deceptions. They got the important seats at the synagogue. They were greeted in the marketplace. They had all the hallmarks of religious achievement and success. But Jesus sees through their veneer. Again, verse 5. Everything, he says, they do is done for people to see. And the truth is that Jesus sees through my veneer and my packaging and yours too. You know, we don't wear phylacteries, but we can wear a fake smile on a Sunday morning, pretending like everything's okay. We can adjust our image to fit the people in our small group, or we speak about Jesus in ways that get us praise. And of course, it's not just here in the church. It's the world around us as well. American culture only makes this worse in the way it rewards superficial success. Don't believe me? Check out the magazines in the checkout line at the supermarket next time you're buying groceries. Just look at the covers. They will scream at you about the image you are supposed to have, how you are to look, what you should wear, how you should act, how your house should be decorated, where you should travel. See, our criteria for what is good and healthy and normal is so completely out of whack, but we swim in this water, it's hard for us to see any more than a fish can see the water. It's hard to recognize the disease of deceit when everybody else calls it health. And the anxious thoughts of deceit can be especially hard to see in our own hearts. You know, this week I was talking with somebody about just some of the events that have been going on in Washington, D.C., and the controversial confirmation hearings, and I wanted to share with this person about something that I had read. And so as I began, I said, you know, I don't spend a whole lot of time on Facebook, but the other day I saw this article that somebody posted. Do you see what I did there? Do you hear the deceit in my voice? You see, I believe that many people spend way too much time on Facebook. In fact, to be really honest with you, I believe that I can spend way too much time on Facebook. But I don't want you to know that about me, because I don't want you to think less of me. And so I throw in this little disclaimer. You know, I manipulate the way the other person sees me. I've just added another black stripe to my zebra disguise. But here's the moral of the story. You can pretend that you are a zebra for a while. You might even convince yourself that you are a zebra. But sooner or later, the truth comes out, and it becomes obvious to everyone else, even if it's not obvious to you, that you are not a zebra. You're just an ass. Galatians 6:3. Paul says, if anyone thinks they are something when they are not, they deceive themselves. See, we need to know our hearts, because we can become the deceiver and the deceived. We spend much of our life automatically and unconsciously presenting a false self to the world in order to influence people into giving us the response that honestly our hearts really deeply long for. Over time, we begin to accept that false image as actually being real. We believe our own press. We become pleased with our crowd-pleasing image and deceive ourselves into believing we actually are our persona. We lose track of where the false self we present ends and where our true self begins. As the 19th century novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote, no man for any considerable period can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be the true. So we deceive ourselves because we so badly need to believe that we actually are who we think we need to be in order for others to see us in a positive light. Our deceptions of others and our deceptions of ourselves, it's driven by a deep need. But it may not be the need that we think. Many of us think we need to be successful, to achieve, to produce. But if we actually begin to peel back the layers, and this, by the way, is incredibly difficult to do, but if we begin to peel back the layers and we truly know our hearts, what we find is that we've actually come to believe that we need to succeed in order to be loved. You see, many people had an early childhood experience of shame and embarrassment for not performing well in the eyes of parents or others, and they did not receive attention and praise for their achievements or for their leadership. In response, they've come to believe that they can only be loved by being or appearing successful, by avoiding failure at all costs, by aligning their image to the crowd they want to please. They believe that the world only values people for what they do rather than for who they are. And so being on top, being successful, for many people feels like a matter of life and death. The great danger of deceit here is that I come to believe that I am what I do rather than I am a beloved child of God. And this leads to a huge identity crisis. When you create the image in order to get the love, what gets loved is the image, not necessarily you, the person behind the facade. And here's what's insidious. This just intensifies the conviction that you can't be loved as you are. It reinforces the decision to deceive, to construct an image, to get the love. And while our deceptions cut us off from our own hearts, from our feelings, and our emotional life, for those entangled in a web of self-deception, emotions are counterproductive. They get in the way of progress. It doesn't matter that you're sad or you're angry or you're afraid, as long as the job gets done and it gets recognized. But fear inevitably creeps in like an overnight fog. Many people live with an underlying and unconscious fear of failure that never goes away. It's a fear of being weak and incompetent and no longer able to perform. This is why sickness in old age can be so threatening for so many people, because we can no longer offer what we used to. The motto, I produce, therefore I am, inevitably breaks down. Our self-deception also cuts us off from our ability to give and receive love with others. If I believe that I'm only loved for what I do, what I produce, what I contribute, then love becomes another transaction or an exchange where I'm earning or buying what I need. I had this experience just a couple of weeks ago. I was having coffee with a good friend of mine who I genuinely love and value and appreciate, but he's going through a really rough time right now. There's some stuff in his family that is just rocking his world. And as we talked, I realized there was a place where he had a need that I could meet, and I offered to help him. I offered to spend a considerable amount of time and my energy working on something for him. And I was startled when, after making the offer, he looked at me and said, "Can I pay you for that?" See, he had to make an exchange. He couldn't just receive the gift of love. I felt stung, but I also recognized that's how he rolls. See, my friend is very successful, and how others perceive him is very important to him. Consequently, he couldn't just receive my love and service as a gift without feeling the need to earn it and to pay for it. Can you relate to that? See, as he gets to know his own heart, though, what I love about him is that he is learning that his heart longs for more than just recognition he can earn. He longs for unmerited, unconditional love that cannot be earned. And we all do. There was a guy named Milton Lichtman, also known as Jan Leighton. He died at the age of 87 in 2009. For over 30 years, Lichtman's primary claim to fame was appearing in commercials as famous historical figures. He lit a cigar as Fidel Castro in commercial lighters, sold cars as Albert Einstein for a Southern California car dealership. He promoted a Minnesota savings bank as Abraham Lincoln. He pitched cereal as Alexander Hamilton, beer as Johann Sebastian Bach, early mobile phones as Dracula, and cough syrup as Frankenstein. Among others, Babe Ruth, Gandhi, Mozart, Sherlock Holmes, Ebenezer Scrooge, John Wayne, Thomas Jefferson, and even Margaret Thatcher were in his repertoire. Asked once how he was doing, he replied, quote, "I am alive and well and living in someone else's face." By the end of his career, Lichtman reportedly portrayed 3,372 historic notables, and the Guinness Book of World Records credited him as the actor who played the most roles and had the most disguises. So it's no wonder that he said, and I quote, "Heaven for me is to lie in bed stark naked with no costume, living in my own face and not someone else's, and luxuriate in my own skin." Is there something in you, in your heart, that just longs for that? To live in your own face, in your own skin? To stop deceit, pretending to be someone you're not? To drop the false self that you put on and to live into your true self? So as we're talking again about spiritual formation this fall, that's part of what it's about. It's to become your true self. Because you were created in the image of God, and Jesus Christ is the visible image of the invisible God, you and I are meant to be more like Jesus in every way that matters. When we become our true selves, we become more like Christ. And while this is the work of God's grace within us, we always have ways we can and should cooperate with God's Spirit. So let me end by just suggesting three spiritual disciplines, three spiritual practices that can help you get to know your heart and to address the anxious thoughts of deceit. First is the practice of solitude. Of solitude. Now let me put on like the Surgeon General's warning with this. If you struggle with deceit, this could feel brutal. Because it's hard to be alone when you're used to getting your sense of self from the image you put forward and the response you get from others. But we need a place of seclusion where we get no public feedback, no applause, no admiration for a job well done. This is why Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you'll have no reward from your Father who is in heaven." So solitude means setting apart time and space to be with God, to be alone with God and God alone. Henry Nouwen, one of the leading Christian writers in spiritual life, says, "Without solitude, it is virtually impossible to live a spiritual life. Solitude begins with a time and place for God and Him alone. If we really believe not only that God exists, but also that He is actively present in our lives, healing, teaching, and guiding, then we need to set aside a time and space to give Him our undivided attention." Now, this could look different for everybody, considering your age or life stage, your job, your family obligations, your temperament. But would you engage in a practice of solitude, particularly if you're struggling with deceit? Start small. 5 or 10 minutes a day might be all you can handle. But be regular. It's better to have a daily practice of 10 minutes of solitude than to have a whole hour once in a while. And here, y'all heard the phrase, "Don't just sit there, do something." Flip that on its head. Don't just do something, sit there. Again, here's some wisdom from Henry Nouwen. Our temptation is to do something useful, to read something stimulating, to think about something interesting, or to experience something unusual. But our moment of solitude is precisely a moment in which we want to be in the presence of our Lord with empty hands, naked, vulnerable, useless, without much to show, prove, or defend. That is how we slowly learn to listen to God's small voice. See, our goal is not to be successful at solitude and get a lot out of it. Our goal is to be in God's presence and to be loved. So a first discipline is solitude. A second is very similar. It's the discipline of silence. Ecclesiastes, the wisdom there, says there's a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be silent and a time to speak. The spiritual discipline of silence is often the companion to solitude. Solitude is getting away from other people to be with God and God alone. Silence is the practice of getting away from noise to listen to God and God alone. So again, finding time to be without words, an afternoon or a whole day, maybe even a weekend. Let others know what you're doing so that they can help you by not trying to get a response from you. And if people do ask you to speak, certainly let charity, let love be your guide. I mean, if somebody's about to be hit by a bus, by all means, yell. But the point is to not use our words or text. No texting. To see the way in which words are used to manipulate an image. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said that anyone who thinks that his time is too valuable to spend keeping quiet will eventually have no time for God and his brother, but only for himself and his own follies. Final discipline, in addition to solitude and silence, is secrecy. This is not just keeping others' secrets, which is important, but keeping our own. See, the practice of secrecy is Jesus' gift to approval addicts. It liberates those who are trapped by the desire to be seen, to impress others. In the discipline of secrecy, we resist the urge to make sure our good deeds and good qualities are well known. We may even take steps to keep them from being known. We let God instead be our PR department. As Richard Foster notes, nothing disciplines the inordinate desires of the flesh like service, and nothing transforms the desires of the flesh like serving in hiddenness. So try that. Try serving somebody without getting any recognition. Make a lavish donation to a ministry, or give generously to a person or family in need and keep it all anonymous. Memorize scripture and recite it to no one. Do somebody else's laundry. Clean somebody else's room. Do a project for somebody at work. Help somebody out at school without trying to get notice for it. There are a million ways to do this. But again, the whole point of these disciplines of solitude, of silence, and of secrecy is for us to cooperate with the work that the Spirit of God is already doing in you and in me of transforming us so that we might be more like Christ. And that would include healing us from the disease of deceit, of the need to put forth an image because we think that will get us the love that truly will only be found in knowing that we are the beloved children of God. So beloved that God came and took on human flesh for you and for me, to be not only a model of what life was to be like, how we are to live, but to live in our place and to die in our place and to rise again in our place so that as we are united with him, we get all the benefits of his life, death, and resurrection, including the power to free us from where death is at work in us, including in our anxious thoughts. And so this morning, as part of our worship, we're going to receive the gifts of the Lord's table, the sacrament of communion, the gifts of grace. Because grace isn't just what saves us from sin, death, and the devil. Grace is also what sustains and strengthens us as we grow and are formed in the image of Christ.